It's the early morning of December 20th, 1991, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Lancaster is in the heart of Amish country, with horse and buggy carriages driving alongside cars, cows grazing in place of power lines, and white barnwood farmhouses situated only a couple miles from bustling shopping malls. It's an area that combines modernity and the simple life. While the Amish reject most modern amenities like electricity, there were other religious families in the area, such as Mennonites and Presbyterians, that lived a typical modern American life in the 1990s. One of those families was the Shows. Hazel Show was a single mother who lived in a condominium in Lancaster. She had a 16-year-old daughter, Lori, and worked as a nurse at the local community hospital. She came from a religious family and didn't really believe in divorce. But she was currently separated from her husband, John Cho. They had an on-again, off-again relationship, but they were currently in an off phase. Hazel had gotten up extra early the morning of December 20th because she had a meeting with her daughter's school counselor. The day before, she received a call from the counselor asking to set a meeting for tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. before school started to discuss an issue that Lori was having at school. Hazel agreed, but when she later asked Lori what this meeting was about, Lori had no idea. She told her mother she was having no issues at school, and there must be some sort of mistake. 16-year-old Lori Sho was a sophomore at Conestoga Valley High School. She was a tall, self-assured young woman with curly blonde hair and a sweet smile. She had some issues with other teenagers in the area before, but as of late, everything was normal at school, and she definitely wasn't having any issues with her classmates. That morning, Lori was drying her hair in the bathroom, getting ready for the last day of school before winter break. As Hazel was leaving for the appointment, Lori still had no idea what this meeting could possibly be about, but her mother assured her that it was probably a misunderstanding and she would handle it. Hazel left the apartment, and with the sun barely up, she got into her car to drive to the school. When she arrived, she was directed to the counselor's office and sat on a chair outside the door while she waited. And waited. And waited. 7 minutes had passed. The counselor was either late or wasn't coming, but Hazel wasn't wasting any more time. Christmas was right around the corner, and she had a ton to get done. So she left a note for the counselor and left the school. When she arrived home around 7:20, one of her neighbors, Richard Kleinhaus, was near the staircase leading up to her apartment. He asked Hazel if everything was okay because he heard a commotion coming up from her apartment. Hazel told him it was probably nothing, as everything was a commotion when it came to teenagers. She said goodbye and went up to her apartment. She entered the house and called out for Lori. But when Lori didn't answer, she thought perhaps she had left for school already. As Hazel walked down the hallway, she looked into the bathroom and noticed that Lori had left her curling iron plugged in. This struck Hazel as odd because it was unlike Lori to do that, and Lori's boyfriend was a volunteer firefighter, so she knew how dangerous it was. Hazel unplugged the iron and made her way into Lori's room. What Hazel found in that bedroom would completely demolish her world. Not only because she was presented with a horrific sight, but because she suddenly realized that the counselor meeting was a setup to leave her daughter unprotected. Hi, strangers. This is your host, Alexa Morrissey. And today I have a case that, on the surface, seems open and shut. And yet, I will have to tell it to you in several parts. Because you see, once I started my research for this episode, I quickly realized that this case is far more complicated than it appears. And there's definitely more than one rabbit hole to fall down into. And I have to warn you, today's story involves a lot of violence among teenagers. And in order to get a better understanding of the story, I want you to remember that time in your life when you were a teen. You felt everything so intensely,
and it was hard to see that the world didn't revolve around you and your friends' everyday lives. And I'm sure all of us can remember that unique heartache of seeing the person you liked with somebody else, and how that felt like the end of the world. But in this case, that teenage heartbreak morphed into something twisted and evil, and ended up leading to the brutal death of a girl in her own home. This is part one of The Murder of Laurie Show. Lock your doors and listen closely. This is Stranger in the House. Laurie Michelle Show was born on January 27th, 1975. Her parents, Hazel and John Show, named her Laurie after her mother's middle name. She was a friendly kid who loved to talk to her neighbors and had a real sense of adventure. According to Lynn Riddle's book, Overkill, when Laurie was about 4 years old, she was left alone watching TV while Hazel was cleaning in a different room. Hazel came back to find Laurie missing from the house. She checked the neighbors' houses and the backyard, and she was nowhere to be found. Desperate, Hazel walked across the street to an Amish schoolhouse. There were horses and buggies outside the school, and while Hazel knew Laurie would never approach them, Hazel had to ask the Amish men in the school if they had seen her daughter. They pointed inside to the schoolhouse, and there, in the front row of desks, was Laurie, happily coloring by herself. Apparently, she had wandered into the schoolhouse to see what was going on, and the men gave her some crayons, instantly falling in love with her sweet and curious nature. Laurie was also an extremely accident-prone kid. She broke so many bones over the years that Hazel went to the doctor to see if there was anything wrong with her, but the doctor just said, "She's a klutz." Despite being a generally happy, albeit a little clumsy kid, Laurie started to lash out at her mother as she approached her teen years. Hazel and John Cho were Christian and didn't necessarily believe in divorce. But soon after Laurie was born, they started to have issues. They would fight, and John would move out, and then they would reconcile, and the cycle would start all over again. After a while, John moved out for good, and Laurie blamed her mother for his absence. Laurie and her mother were living with each other and constantly fighting. One day, Hazel was fed up with Laurie's attitude and actually dropped her off at her dad's house so that they could have a break from each other. And that's how a lot of mother-teenage-daughter relationships are, full of animosity and rage-fueled fights. But eventually, the teen matures and things start to get better. And that's what happened with Laurie. By the time she started high school, she and her mom were in a better place and actually started to get along. According to Overkill, Laurie struggled in school. She was diagnosed with dyslexia and spent several years in special education. Her mom was her biggest advocate and helped her eventually become a successful student. And by the time she got to high school, she was in regular classes. In 11th grade, she decided that she wanted to go to cosmetology school, but her real dream was to become a model. Laurie was tall and thin, and she often was mistaken for older than she was. She was self-assured and confident, but to some fellow teenagers, those qualities came off as snobbish. The summer Laurie turned 16, she and her mother moved into a condominium. Laurie wanted to make friends near her new home and started hanging out with a local group of teenagers. At first, Hazel thought they were a nice group of kids, but soon she noticed that some of her jewelry was missing, and then small bills from a jar in the kitchen. According to Hazel, Laurie seemed oblivious to her new friend stealing. Eventually, Hazel had her two police officer friends talk to Laurie about hanging out with the wrong crowd. From then on, she never hung out with those friends again, but now she was lonely. In May of 1991, Laurie met a girl named Rachel on the bus. She was around Laurie's age and lived in the complex across the street from Laurie's. She was nice and friendly, and since Laurie was looking to make new friends, Rachel introduced Laurie to some of hers. That's when Laurie Show first met Michelle Lambert.
We'll be right back.
Sixteen-year-old Lori Sho was looking to make new friends near the condominium that she and her mother had just moved into when she met a girl named Rachel on the local bus. Rachel had invited Lori over to her house to hang out with some friends after school. That's where she met 19-year-old Lisa Michelle Lambert, who went by Michelle. Michelle was described as a real-life Barbie doll, with bleach blonde hair, tan skin, and striking blue contact lenses. But her personality was far from sunny and fun. Everyone that knew Michelle said that she was smart, but calculated. According to the book Overkill by Lynn Riddle, Lori found Michelle self-centered, overbearing, and kind of mean. One day while they were hanging out, Lori mentioned to Michelle that she'd like to be a model. And Michelle's response was that she couldn't be a model because she wasn't pretty enough. When Lori first met Michelle, she was dating a young man named Lawrence Youngkin. He was 20 years old, handsome, and a former athlete. He and Michelle were constantly breaking up and getting back together. And a few weeks after Lori met Michelle and Lawrence, the couple broke up again, and Lawrence actually asked Lori out on a date. Hazel Sho believes that her daughter went out with him out of pity because he was so upset about his breakup with Michelle. And she thinks her daughter really just saw him as a friend. They went to the mall together, the petting zoo, and sometimes he just came over to watch TV with her family. Lori's father, John Sho, thought he was nice enough, but didn't like that his 16-year-old daughter was with the 20-year-old. Not too long into Lori and Lawrence's relationship, Hazel Sho got a phone call from Lori's ex, Michelle Lambert. Michelle wanted to tell Lori that she was pregnant with Lawrence's baby. After the call, Hazel told Lawrence that he needed to talk to Michelle and deal with the fact that his ex was pregnant, and that he and Lori needed to break up so she wasn't involved in any of this. And both Lori and Lawrence agreed that separating was for the best. And that was it for a time. Lawrence and Michelle got back together and had a baby on the way, and Lori started a new job at a women's clothing store in a nearby mall. On July 5th, 1991, Lori was working at the store when Michelle came in. According to Overkill, Michelle was screaming at Lori, accusing her of sleeping with her boyfriend and calling her names like slut and whore. After her tirade, she left the store as Lori just stood in shock. That night, Lori called Michelle and told her never to come back to her work again. But Michelle's response was only more obscenities, and she just continued to call Lori names. A few days later, as Lori was leaving her job, Michelle attacked her outside her store. She stepped in front of Lori and shoved her against a wall. Lori's mother, Hazel, was waiting in her car to pick Lori up after work and saw the whole thing. But when Hazel went to confront Michelle, a tearful Lori told her no. It would only make matters worse. When they got home, Hazel called the township police to report the incident, but the deputy told her there was nothing that could be done. To them, no one was hurt, and it was just a pregnant teenager shoving another teenager. Despite this, Hazel and John Sho were not going to let their daughter be harassed, so they created a schedule that would prevent Lori from ever being alone in public. Her parents took her to and from school and work every day, and her new boyfriend, Brad, helped out by driving her places when her parents couldn't. A couple days after Hazel called the police, Lori and her father went to the mall, where they unfortunately ran into Michelle. John was sure that because he was with her, Michelle wouldn't try anything with Lori. But it seemed that nothing was going to stop Michelle. Michelle walked right up to John Sho and told him that his daughter had sex with her boyfriend and was a slut. Lawrence, Lori's ex and current boyfriend of Michelle, stood behind Michelle and said nothing. According to Overkill, John had to do everything in his power not to smack this pregnant teen. So he turned to Lawrence. He said, "You better get her out of here. I have really lost respect for you to let your girlfriend do this." Lori was terrified of Michelle, and her parents couldn't understand Michelle's intense hatred of their daughter. The night of the mall incident, Lori told her mother that while she was dating Lawrence, he had taken her to a secluded road in his parents' van and raped her. Lori believed that Michelle had found out about this incident and thought it had been consensual and was furious. Hazel asked Lori if she wanted to report the rape, but she told her mother that she wouldn't for now because it would only cause more problems with Michelle and Lawrence, and she was scared of what Michelle would do. On August 1st, 1991, Lori called her mother while she was at work. She was terrified because Lawrence and Michelle were waiting outside the store. Hazel immediately called the police, and an officer named Robin Weaver was sent to the mall to question Michelle and Lawrence. After he questioned them, he came into the store and asked Lori what was going on. Lori told him about the rape, and he asked her if she wanted to press charges against Lawrence, but she said no. Officer Weaver told her to let him know if she changed her mind, and on his way out of the store, he told Michelle and Lawrence to leave Lori alone. On August 20th, Lori went to an outdoor farmer's market with her mom. While roaming the stalls, Lori spotted Lawrence and Michelle in the crowd. Lori begged her mother to leave, but Hazel told her no, they were not going to live in fear and change their plans because of this girl. Unfortunately, Michelle spotted them and began screaming, "Your daughter fucked my boyfriend," and caused a huge scene. Hazel demanded that Michelle stop, but she wouldn't let up, and that's when Hazel blurted out that Lori was raped by Lawrence, and if Michelle didn't stop this, they were going to bring charges against him. Hazel then threatened to call the police, which prompted the couple to quickly move away. According to Overkill by Lynn Riddle, Hazel was struck by Lawrence's reaction. He didn't say anything, but he looked pleased, as if he liked the idea of the girls fighting over him. We'll be right back. For most of 1991, 16-year-old Lori Sho was harassed by another local teenager, 19-year-old Michelle Lambert. Michelle was furious at Lori for sleeping with her ex-boyfriend at the time, Lawrence Youngkin. While Lawrence and Michelle had reconciled and actually had a baby on the way, Michelle still held animosity toward Lori. She had attacked Lori outside her work and consistently called the Sho household until they were forced to change their number. In late August, during a confrontation between Michelle, Lawrence, and the Shows, Lori's mother threatened to report Lawrence for raping Lori earlier that year if Michelle didn't stop her harassment of her daughter. Lori spent the rest of the summer and fall looking over her shoulder. She lived in constant fear of Michelle. On November 22, 1991, Lori was standing outside her work in the mall parking lot with some friends when Michelle and Lawrence pulled up. Michelle jumped out of the car and pushed Lori to the ground. Lori was a tall girl and could have easily overpowered a shorter Michelle. But remember, Michelle was 6 months pregnant at this point, and Lori didn't want to fight back because of this. Michelle kept screaming, "You ruined my life. You ruined my baby's life." All while Lawrence watched from the car. Michelle eventually fled when she saw a security guard coming towards them. It was at this point that Hazel Sho had enough. She didn't want her daughter living in constant fear over this girl. That night, she and Lori went to the police station and took out a warrant for simple assault against Michelle Lambert. After they filed assault charges against Michelle, it seemed like they had maybe scared her off. And as Christmas approached, the Sho family was finally starting to feel like they were getting back to normal. At Hazel and Lori's apartment, Lori and her friends decorated the Christmas tree with her family heirlooms and crafts they made themselves. They were all getting ready for the upcoming break. On December 19th, the day before the last day of school before winter break, Hazel was at work when she got a call from Lori's school counselor. "Mrs. Sho, this is Mrs. Cooper from Conestoga Valley High School. I'm wondering if you can meet me at the school tomorrow morning. I need to talk to you about a problem with Lori." The counselor said that something had happened with Lori and a boy at school today, but she didn't want to elaborate over the phone. Hazel agreed to meet Mrs. Cooper at 7:30 a.m. the next day. 20 minutes later, the phone rang again. "Mrs. Sho, this is Mrs. Cooper. I forgot. I have a meeting at Conestoga Valley Junior High School on Friday. Could you meet me there instead at about 7 a.m?" Hazel agrees to the new time and location, and later asks Lori about the incident with the boy. But Lori just seems confused. She insists nothing out of the ordinary happened at school today, and there definitely wasn't a problem with any boy. Lori was baffled, but Hazel suggested that maybe it was just some kind of mix-up, and told her daughter she would get it settled tomorrow morning. Despite her mom's assurance, the call still bugged Lori, and later that chilly December night, she was hanging out with her father and told him about the mysterious call. They had driven to a Lancaster greenhouse because during the holidays, her father sold local poinsettias in Philadelphia. As Lori and her dad were loading up the car with the festive plants, she told him that something about the call didn't feel right. She thought the counselor was going to blame her for something she didn't do, but her dad told her not to worry and that her mom would take care of it. The two of them had fried chicken at KFC for dinner, and then John Cho drove his daughter back to her mom's apartment. This brings us to the morning of December 20th. Hazel Cho waits about 10 minutes for the counselor, Mrs. Cooper, at the local junior high before deciding to leave a note and head home. When she gets back to the apartment complex, a neighbor is waiting outside and tells her that he heard a commotion that morning coming from her apartment. Hazel brushes it off and tells the neighbor it was probably nothing. She enters the house and calls out to Lori. But when Lori doesn't answer, she thinks perhaps she's left for school already. As Hazel walks down the hallway, she looks into the bathroom and notices that Lori has left the curling iron plugged in, which is unlike her. Hazel then makes her way into Lori's room. And to her horror, she sees her 16-year-old daughter lying in a pool of blood on the floor. She had been stabbed, and it looked like her throat had been slit. There also seemed to be a rope tied around her neck. And even more shocking, 16-year-old Lori Cho was still alive, moaning in pain. Once the immediate shock of what she discovers dissipates, Hazel runs to the front door and screams for her neighbors to call 911. She runs back in and grabs a knife from the kitchen because she noticed that Lori had some sort of white rope tied around her neck. According to court documents, Hazel darts back into Lori's room and slides the knife between the rope and Lori's neck and slices it off. Once the rope is removed, Hazel sees that the gash in Lori's neck is much worse than it first appeared. Desperate, she cradles Lori in an attempt to hold her neck together. Sobbing, Hazel tells Lori she's so sorry, that the meeting was a setup, and she asks, who did this to her? With the words barely audible, Lori says, Michelle. Michelle did it. She tells her mother she loves her until she's just mouthing the words. Minutes later, paramedics arrived, and when they first walked into the room, they froze. Hazel, covered in her daughter's blood, screamed that she wasn't the killer and they needed to do something while Lori still had a weak pulse. According to 2004 court documents, Officer Robin Weaver of the East Lampeter Township Police Department testified at approximately 7:45 a.m., he and Corporal Jan Fasnet were the first officers to arrive at the crime scene. By the time the police started to look around and confirm that the attacker or attackers were no longer in the house, Lori Cho was declared dead. The Lancaster Police Department was not one that dealt with murder often. In fact, this was the first homicide that Lancaster had seen in over a decade. Most of the police officers who arrived at the scene had never seen so much blood in their lives. The medical examiner would later find that Lori had bruises on her head, 3 cuts on her back from stab wounds, a cut on her upper thigh that penetrated her pelvis, 21 cuts on her hands that were labeled defensive wounds, and a 5-inch gash through her throat. They said that the neck and an upper chest wound were what killed her, but that she was able to live 30 minutes after the attack. After her daughter was declared dead, Hazel Cho sat at the kitchen table, covered in blood, until she was taken to her brother's house while police locked off the scene. Lori's father arrived a little while after she was declared dead, and from the police barricades outside, he screamed at the officers that they knew Michelle was after her, and if they had just arrested her, none of this would have happened. As mentioned, Lori and Hazel had filed a simple assault charge against Michelle in November. But because it was simple assault by a pregnant teenage girl, the police didn't regard it as a pressing issue. So they didn't start their investigation into the assault until December 16th. But that was far too late, because 4 days later, Lori Cho was dead. Officer Robin Weaver, the same man who was called to Lori's store when Michelle and Lawrence were hanging around outside, was one of the officers at the crime scene. He remembered the event and that he had told the couple to leave Lori alone. As Weaver looked around the house, he noticed that there were no signs of forced entry, that there was only one way into the apartment, and all the windows were still locked. This suggested that Lori knew her attacker and let them in. But that begs the question, why would Lori Show ever let Michelle Lambert into her house willingly? The bloody rope that was tied around Lori's neck was taken in as evidence, as well as several small clumps of Lori's hair that were found on the floor. According to 2004 court documents, the resident of the apartment below the Shows, Richard G. Kleinhaus, said that he woke up around 5:45 a.m. that morning. From his window, he saw Hazel Show leave the apartment, and then, a little later, Kleinhaus heard the front door slam above him, followed by a scream and a thump on the floor. 6 or 8 minutes later, he heard the door slam again. At that time, around 10 or 12 minutes after 7 o'clock, he looked out the window and saw two people of identical heights, approximately 5 feet 7 inches, exit the stairwell. Frederick Fry, another resident of the complex, testified that at 7:13 a.m., he was waiting in his car while he let the engine idle for a little while. As he backed his car out, Fry saw two individuals to his right. They passed in front of his car as he started forward. He saw that one person was a little shorter and heavier than the other. He estimated that the shorter person was approximately 5'3 to 5'5, and the taller girl was approximately 5'5 to 5'7. He believed, based on his observations, that they were both women. With this information, the police had a feeling they knew who one of those women might be. And so began their search for 19-year-old Michelle Lambert. At 10:30 a.m., the East Lampeter police issued a press release telling the public that they were on the lookout for a two-toned Mercury Monarch occupied by a white male in his late teens, early 20s, and an 18-year-old pregnant female. No names were revealed, but everyone in the small town knew that the police were on the lookout for Michelle Lambert and Lawrence Youngkin. The police couldn't find Michelle or Lawrence for most of the day. Apparently, the two of them had moved into a trailer together, but the police were struggling to find its exact location. At 10 p.m. that night, they finally got a tip. Michelle, Lawrence, and their 17-year-old friend, Tabitha Buck, were spotted hanging out at a bowling alley in Strasbourg, a town just south of Lancaster. Six officers arrived at the bowling alley at 10:30 p.m. and promptly arrested Michelle and Lawrence. They had an outstanding noise complaint against Lawrence and the simple assault charge against Michelle. Their friend Tabitha wasn't initially a suspect in any of this, but then police noticed something strange as they led Michelle and Lawrence out of the bowling alley. Tabitha had a large, fresh scratch on her face. Police told her that they were going to drive her to the police station for questioning and call her mother, as she was a juvenile and they couldn't question her without a parent. According to Overkill, Tabitha's mother, Joanne Geer, was at home watching a news report on Lori's murder when she got the call from the police. When Joanne arrived, the police did not tell her what they wanted to question Tabitha about. She and her daughter sat down in a beige office in the police station at around 11:30 p.m. as Pennsylvania State Trooper and experienced interrogator Donald Schneider started to question her about her day. 17-year-old Tabitha said that Michelle and Lawrence had picked her up from her house around 6:20 a.m. that morning. They went to the local Kmart, but had to wait outside because it wasn't open yet while Lawrence drove off to McDonald's to get coffee. When he came back, they hopped in the car and drove off. Tabitha said that Lawrence noticed something was wrong with a tire and drove them to another McDonald's parking lot to check it out. While the two girls waited for Lawrence to find the issue, Tabitha said that two, quote, Puerto Rican girls started calling out to Lawrence, which resulted in Michelle yelling back at them. A screaming match escalated into a physical fight, and one of the girls hit Tabitha in the face with something like a key, and that's how she got the scratch on her face. She said that Lawrence broke up the fight and they eventually went back in the car. She said they went to fill Lawrence's tires at a local car wash. Then they got a little lost driving her to her high school, where she was a senior. Tabitha checked into school at 9 a.m., an hour late. She told several members of the school staff that her face was scratched by some, quote, Mexican girls that morning. It was about 2 a.m. when the police told Tabitha and her mother that they could leave. But Trooper Snyder decided to tell them one more thing before they did. He said, Lori is dead. Tabitha's mother was shocked and confused by this statement. But Tabitha immediately collapsed into her mother's arms and started to sob. Meanwhile, in another room a few doors down, 20-year-old Lawrence Yunkin was telling detectives a similar story. He said he went to McDonald's, Kmart, McDonald's again to check his car, and then Tabitha and Michelle got attacked by, quote, Spanish girls. He said that other than that, nothing special had happened that day. In another room, 19-year-old Michelle Lambert's interrogation went a little differently. She was informed that she was being arrested for the November assault of Lori Show. According to Overkill, Sergeant Carl Harnish described Michelle as calm and talked with him very casually, as if he were a friend. He asked her how she knew Lori, and she said she met Lori this summer at her friend Rachel's house. Michelle told the sergeant that during that first meeting, Lori was threatening to beat up Rachel, and Michelle told her to leave Rachel alone. But then, as if she were telling a funny secret, leaned in and said, it didn't matter now, though, because Michelle didn't even like Rachel anymore. She told Sergeant Harnish that Lori had slept with Lawrence 4 times while they were broken up. And after she and Lawrence reconciled, she attacked Lori at the mall, but then didn't see Lori until November. She said that's when she pushed Lori to the ground, and then Lori started to fight back and kicked pregnant Michelle in the stomach. Michelle then told a similar story to Tabitha and Lawrence's. McDonald's, Kmart, McDonald's again, fight with the girls in the parking lot, and then they dropped off Tabitha at school. She said that after that, she did some laundry, watched some TV, nothing out of the ordinary. Eventually, the sergeant asked Michelle if she knew why she was here, and she said she didn't. He told her that Lori Show had been murdered. Like Tabitha, Michelle broke down and cried. But through her tears, she denied being involved in the murder. She said the worst she ever said she would do to Lori is beat her up. When Sergeant Harnish left the room and met up with his colleagues in the hallway, they discussed how something was up, because the 3 stories about the morning were exactly the same and felt rehearsed. It was about 1:30 a.m. when Detective Raymond Salt went in to question Michelle. He started by reiterating that Lori was dead, and was disturbed by Michelle's reaction. This time, Michelle looked alarmed. She said, "Oh my God, she's dead?" Now obviously this was odd, because she was already told Lori was dead by Sergeant Harnish. The detective called her out on her little performance, and started to question Michelle again. And Michelle's story changed several times over the course of the evening. First, Michelle said that she wasn't at Lori's house at all that morning. Then, after further questioning, she said that, okay, yes, she was there, but she didn't see anything because she stayed outside at the bottom of the condominium stairs while Lawrence and Tabitha went into the apartment. A little later, she said that she saw Lawrence attack Lori, but the police asked her how she could possibly have seen that if she was downstairs. So then she said, okay, yes, she went up to the top of the stairs and looked inside the house, but she didn't go in. Then, hours later, Michelle Lambert finally confessed to being in the apartment. But she said it was Tabitha who was the crazed killer, and it was Michelle who actually tried to save Lori's life. She said that all she wanted to do that morning was talk to Lori and humiliate her by cutting off her hair as a prank. She said that Tabitha lost it when they got in the apartment and wouldn't stop stabbing Lori. In this version of Michelle's story, Lawrence had not been at the apartment at all. By 4 a.m., everyone was exhausted, but the police thought it was time to check on Lawrence, who had not broken down and still maintained his first story. Sergeant Harnish went into the room where Lawrence was being held and gave him some bad news. The girls were pinning the murder on him. When Lawrence heard this, he immediately was ready to tell a new story. Lawrence said that everything started the night before the murder. he said that he had taken Michelle to Kmart and waited in the car while she shopped. After she was done, she went over to Tabitha's house and he looked in the shopping bag. He said that there was a white nylon rope and a black ski hat inside. After a while, he said he went home and picked Michelle and Tabitha up from Tabitha's house around 6:30 a.m. the next morning. They told Lawrence to drop them off at Lori's apartment complex and wait at the nearby McDonald's for 30 minutes before coming back to pick them up. Lawrence told police that he assumed Lori's mother Hazel would be there so early in the morning, and he had no idea what they were planning to do to Lori. He said after about 30 minutes, he drove to where they said he should pick them up. But they weren't there. He said he drove around the block four times waiting for them. He eventually saw them crouching in the bushes near the complex. He said Michelle and Tabitha then got in his car, and when he asked what happened, they wouldn't say. 5 minutes later, he heard Tabitha say, "The bitch scratched me." That's when he said he noticed that Michelle had blood on her hands. By 6 a.m. the next day, Lawrence had one final thing to tell police. He said that he knew where the clothes the girls wore at Lori's house were. He said that after he dropped Tabitha off at school, he and Michelle had washed the clothes at his trailer and then put them in a pink plastic bag. He took the bag and threw it in the dumpster nearby. At this point, police had a lot, but not quite enough to arrest all three for murder. They needed more evidence to show probable cause. They needed to confirm Lawrence's story about the clothes in the plastic bag.
And they were still waiting for the autopsy report.
The issue was that at this time in the state of Pennsylvania, a person needed to be charged with a crime 6 hours after they were arrested or they were able to leave. As the morning rolled around, the Lancaster police were running out of time. They decided to let Tabitha go home with her mother, although they kept a patrol car outside her house for the rest of the day. They charged Lawrence with an outstanding noise violation and charged Michelle with simple assault for her attack on Lori in November. Lawrence and Michelle were moved to the county prison while police started to get their evidence together. As mentioned before, this was their first murder case in a decade, and they wanted to be careful with how they handled everything. That morning, police went to Lawrence and Michelle's trailer after Lawrence told them how to find it. And it was described as a nightmare. There was garbage everywhere, cat feces covered the floor, and the whole trailer reeked of a foul stench. The officers collected a few bloody items and a machete for evidence, and eventually found the pink plastic bag Lawrence spoke of. It had contained two black knit hats, one pair of black gloves, one pair of white gloves, white socks, yellow socks, jeans, black sweatpants, and a flannel coat. Finding this confirmed at least part of Lawrence's story about the day before. Once the evidence was brought back to the station, the autopsy results were in. Lori had been stabbed twice in the head and was beaten with some sort of blunt object. She had stab wounds on her back and legs, and there were dozens of cuts on her hands, suggesting that she was trying to protect herself from a weapon coming at her. It was the brutal slicing of her throat and a stab to the chest that was fatal, and her cause of death was blood loss. That afternoon, the day after Lori's murder, Lawrence Yunkin, Tabitha Buck, and Michelle Lambert were brought in front of a district justice. Michelle and Tabitha were both charged with first-degree murder and no bail. Despite being 17, Tabitha would be tried as an adult. Lawrence was charged with hindering apprehension or prosecution. His bail was set at $1 million. All three were taken to the county prison, where they would await their trials. This seems like an open and shut case, right? Well, not quite. Because in the following years, over the course of multiple trials, everything about this case would be questioned. The Lancaster police would eventually be under investigation by the FBI, and a federal judge would call the case, and I quote, "the worst example of prosecutorial misconduct in the English-speaking world." Hear about all that and more in part two of The Murder of Lori Show. This episode was written by Alexa Morrissey, researched by Victoria Cox, and produced by Michael Morrissey, John Scassia, and Heidi Sherriman. Stranger in the House is a Boy Wonder production. All our sources for this episode will be linked in the bio and on our website, strangerinthehouse.com. You can follow us at strangerinthehouse.com, @_strangerinthehouse on Instagram and TikTok, and @_strangerpod on Twitter. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.